Hello, meat friends. Welcome to the Regenerative Meat Podcast. I'm your host, Brando Tice, and today Frank and I are kicking off Season 2 by sitting down to discuss the apiary Golden Coast Meat is establishing here in Southern California. We start off the conversation discussing the history of buying local and organic honeys and the challenges we ran into trying to support local honey. We then shift the conversation to the local apiary we are starting and some of the challenges we will be facing along the way. Now let's get into it.
Hey, Brando.
Hey, Frank.
Want some mead?
I'd love some mead. What are we drinking today?
Oh, this is our new coffee mead. Blonde Ooh. Coffee mead.
Ooh.
Cheers.
Cheers. Oh, yeah, let me... Blonde coffee.
Mm-hmm. Cheers. Made with Revolution Roasters Night Shift for a less caffeine experience.
Oh.
But I did open this on Sunday.
Okay.
So we're a few days in here, but I think it's got a nice...
Smell like deep caramel, some floral.
Yeah.
Definitely honey.
Oh, yeah. And then this, like, biscuity, nougaty thing.
Mm-hmm.
Which is still there, which is nice. Oh, yeah.
Super smooth.
And, like, rich.
And rich.
Honey comes down the middle. But there's a tart, bright, citrusy kick.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I think our meat is so complex that it overwhelms people.
Like there's just too much going on.
Like they're just like, whoa. And, you know, some people are down for that. And some people are like, well, that's like playing, like just blasting Beethoven in my mouth. I'm like, I was looking for like,
just something simple.
Yeah, I was looking for like elevator jazz, you know.
Yeah. We don't do pop meat here.
No.
Only the classical stuff.
Bum, 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 bum.
But yeah, it's super nice.
Thanks, man. Yeah, I'm excited about it.
Our local buying of honey here in San Diego and how we have tried to buy local honey but have ran into some hiccups and just kind of get some definitions of what is local honey versus regenerative honey and why we're trying to combine them.
Yeah, I have... The best stories that go back to the very beginning about buying honey, because that's where, you know, the idea meets the reality, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like the honey is real. It is nectar gathered from plants, unless it's not. And that's where the story starts. So
that can be a different conversation.
Well, it kind of lays the groundwork for this whole question of real honey. Consistency and quality in honey.
Okay.
And price. Yeah. Right, like these are real aspects of a mead business that we nerd out on and luckily we get to share with our podcast listeners, but rarely do we talk about it out loud with anyone outside of these walls, you know. So yeah. Transparency is lacking in the honey world, and there are some efforts to overcome that, including the Regenerative Apiculture Working Group, which we're a big part of. But TrueSource apparently has made a lot of progress too. They're a verification process that a lot of big packers use.
Oh, okay.
And I'm
like national,
international.
Oh, okay. Cool.
And I just heard this. TrueSource is getting more serious about verifying the legitimacy of the honey. Now, ecological impact of the honey isn't on their radar.
Yeah.
Which is something that the Regenerative Apiculture Working Group is really focused on, and that we hope to establish at our apiary here in San Diego. But the story starts with our first batch of mead and driving out to Colton, California.
Okay.
To Miller's Honey Company, which okay. at the time was like a family owned honey packer and I believe they were still a beekeeping business. My grandpa used to work with them. He used to have them come out to the apple ranch and pollinate the apples.
Oh, okay.
Which is pretty rad. And I would drive up in my station wagon and I would pick up 12 pails of 5 gallons of honey, you know, 12 yeah. 5 gallon buckets of honey and 600 pounds of honey and put it in the back of my station wagon and drive away. And they were super cool. It was like, you know, stopping at your family friend's house, like, hi, okay, yeah, we've got the order for you. Bring your van around the back, you know, and like,
yeah.
they'd fill it up for you and write him a check and boom, business was done. And then one day I showed up, things were different.
Uh-oh.
They didn't let me drive around the back. None of the familiar smiling faces were in the front. They were in like a side office. All the beekeeping equipment that they used to sell in the retail store had gone away. Ooh. And I like saw one of the guys that I knew and I was like, what's going on? And they're like, oh, company got bought by an investment group.
Oh.
And we were like, whoa, okay. Well, am I still going to be able to buy honey from you guys? And they're like, yeah, you buy in big enough quantities that it shouldn't be a problem. Okay. So then I like call them one day. And they're like, we can't sell honey anymore. And I was like, okay, what's going on? And they're like, it's kind of a big deal. We can't talk about it. Turns out they got bought by Greb Farms, which got busted by the Department of Treasury for laundering honey.
Oh, geez.
And yeah, they like, it was one of the biggest fraud cases in like American food history.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and they got busted and broken up and Greb is no longer the owner of Miller's. And anyways, it was
pretty Jeez.
Crazy. Yeah. So we were buying our honey from Subi then after that. Subi is a big co-op of beekeepers and they're out of Anaheim. But they're really more of a honey packer than they are like a beekeeper representative at this point. Like they sell honey at the, you know, bottom price. And we were getting a custom blend of unfiltered California honey called Aunt Sue's blend, and then one day they just switched it on us. And we got this like dark intense mead, and we like had a bunch of obligations to make the mead, so we made the mead and it turned out totally differently. And so we couldn't call it the same mead in good conscience, so we had to call it Speakeasy because it was like dark and kind of intense. And so it became really clear through these experiences. Well, so then we tried to work directly with local beekeepers, and like it was a ton of work. You know, they had to extract all the honey and then drive it down here, or we had to drive it out there to get it. And like the price point would fluctuate based off of what their business model was doing, so it was really hard. And then like the quality would vary majorly, so it would change our product. So it got way too hard to deal with all of these moving parts,
like micro local honey lots essentially.
Yeah, they were small guys producing and extracting their own honey, and therefore the honey was highly variable and the price point was variable. So like trying to line all that up was difficult. And we then started looking for organic honey. We got some organic honey from the Yucatan. And we were really excited about it. It was because like, okay, here's local honey. And the orange blossom that we were buying wasn't available anymore. We became aware of monoculture being a problem, that if you're just growing one kind of crop in one area, you're probably killing everything else or greatly decreasing the ability of anything else to grow in that area. So the actual biodiversity and life that is happening in that place is way small.
Yeah.
So we realized that like buying monoculture honey was not really aligned with our ecological end state that we were after. So then we tried to buy like sage blossom and buckwheat blossom, and we got some awesome batches, but when it came to trying to reproduce them, they were again, you know, highly variable in taste and flavor profile, which like beekeepers aren't set up to measure. Right. Yeah. It's a subjective thing. There aren't objective measurements that you can make a flavor profile. And so like it goes to color and sugar content and water content as like your measurable things, measurable specs. But that doesn't really correlate with actual flavor profile. Right. So. Yeah. So we tried to get clover blossom honey from a cool group of beekeepers out of like the Dakotas, because there's an argument the clover blossom honey is good for the earth. It fixes nitrogen into the ground. It is planted on marginal land so that it grows soil. Arguably clover, and I think there's still an opportunity with clover honey, but the flavor profile was different. It didn't quite work with our sour style that we were really getting into at the time.
Yeah.
So we got some organic honey from the Yucatan through Trade in Organic, an importer. And it was awesome. And we made a batch of mead with it that was like rich and complex. And we called it Yucatan Mirth. And people were into it. We were into it. But like trade-in was like, so can you buy 48 drums? I'm like, no, we can buy one.
And so over like, the next 50 years,
48, yeah. Like, what kind of growth curve do you need us to commit to here? So trade-in kind of stopped calling us back. So we had to find another supplier, and that's where we found B Seasonal, and we were really excited because like we couldn't get organic, and we started to look into organic honey in North America, and we found out that in 2010 USDA convened a advisory board to consult on the National Organic Program's organic honey standard, and they drafted a proposed standard, but there was so much controversy over it because you need 27 square miles of organic pasture to make organic honey if you follow that standard. And that, you know, is very difficult to come across in North America. 27 square miles of certified organic pasture with bees right in the middle of them. So the USDA never certified or ratified, adopted that standard for organic honey. And there was some organic honey being produced in Hawaii, and there still is, but it takes a certifying agency who's willing to work on the livestock loophole, it's called, where like livestock that graze on organic pasture and aren't treated with treatments that are off of the organic standards list can be certified. So the certifying agents look at the range of the bees, and if there's a good case that the bees aren't going into non-certified land and they're being treated with oxalic acid for mite treatments specifically, that is OMRI approved, then they were willing to certify it. And so there's only like a couple producers, and they're all in Hawaii, that make certified organic honey in America. And even some of them have bees that fly over roads where the county is spraying glyphosate to keep the plants from growing onto the roads. So the bees are getting exposed to glyphosate in those cases. So there's only one ranch that I know of where like the bees aren't getting exposed to that, and they've had their honey tested, and it's like the cleanest honey that the labs have seen, according to the stories that I've heard. So that's all to say that organic honey is hard to find in North America. Consistent honey is hard to find. Non-monoculture honey is hard to find. So we had to go to Brazil to get clean, consistent, organic, non-monoculture honey.
Yeah, and I think that leads nicely into regenerative, because ultimately I feel like throughout our journey with honey, we have landed on, we want to get honey that is replenishing the earth. And we could just go find local honey that isn't necessarily doing that, but we want to do better and be better. Thus, our journey all the way to Brazil is where it has landed. Not because we didn't try to do local, and not because we don't want to support local honey at all, but just because that's where a regenerative honey that matches how we want meat to taste and honey and bees to exist, like aligns with like our vision of what mead can be.
Totally. For like 4 years there was this back and forth, like, well, is it better to be organic and foreign or non-organic and local? And you know, the back and forth led us to organic and foreign, but ideally it's organic, regenerative, and local.
Yeah, right?
But actually negotiating and making that happen, like, we've had to invent it ourselves. The Regenerative Apiculture Working Group is this effort to clarify what the standards to make honey that's clean, good for the bees, good for the beekeepers, and good for the lands that they fly on. So what does that actually mean for the beekeepers who have to make these management decisions? What data do they have to collect to then upload that into what interface so that the customer can understand how this honey was made, why it's regenerative, what metrics are actually changing to show that it's increasing the earth's capacity to support life, it's increasing the honeybee's health, it's increasing the beekeeper's livelihood. Like literally yesterday I was talking to a PhD in pollinator ecology about how we measure change to pollinator populations on our apiary sites.
Okay.
So we've got
a potential... Dive into that a little bit more.
Yeah, it's so cool. So, all right, measuring whether it's good for the bees or not is like a matter of, do the bees survive better? Are they healthy? Are there more bees? Might look at how often they swarm, but you know, that's a management decision of whether you let your bees swarm or not, because there's kind of a trade-off between a swarm and honey production. So if you want to maximize honey production, you want to prevent swarming.
What are the benefits of swarming?
Swarming means there's more bees in the world.
Oh, okay.
Your bees have created such a large population that half of them take the old queen and leave. Uh-huh. And leave a new queen and half of the population to then grow. But now there's a whole nother hive out there in nature.
Got it. Okay.
So swarming can be good if we want more bees in the world, right? But from a native pollinator perspective, there are people who argue that European honeybees are problematic. And Marla Spivak, who's a MacArthur Genius Award-winning researcher at University of Minnesota in honeybees and pollinators of all kinds, says, like, let's not pit native pollinators against managed pollinators. Managed pollinators are here. They're going to stay. Our food system depends on them. We got to figure out a way to make space for both native pollinators and managed pollinators. And that means building habitat, restoring habitat that has been degraded or removed. So that's where regenerative beekeeping comes in my mind. It's a beekeeper and a landowner working together to increase habitat for managed pollinators and native pollinators.
Got it.
So we want to measure we want to measure the population of native pollinators and see if the activities of the beekeeper and the landowner increase the population of native pollinators. So, but that's over if we're doing a 1.8 mile radius from the hive, that's 10 square miles of land. If we're doing a 3 mile radius from the hive, that's 27 square miles of land. So we've got to measure the population of native pollinators in across those landscapes in a meaningful way. So I was talking to my friend who's a pollination ecologist PhD about how we go about doing that, and hopefully she's going to submit a proposal that we can incorporate into the regenerative apiculture working group to make happen.
Wow, okay, that makes sense. So then let's go to the apiary that Golden Coast Mead is starting and how that ties into what you're talking about. So have we found a 27 square mile piece of land that we're gonna use? How far along are we in the process? And like, where is it at currently?
Yeah, so there's one here in San Diego County. There's a few steps that need to be taken to lock it in, but we're looking like it's going the right direction. And when those details are locked in, we'll be able to talk about it. But
that's fair.
Our back of the envelope analysis is that it's great that there'll be enough land and enough nectar production to support the 125 hives we want to put out there. But there's a big risk in you know, that's a significant amount of capital, around 25K to buy. And we're working with an apiary in Riverside County that can provide us the bees and the boxes. We don't have to do that work ourselves, but then we take possession of the bees and the equipment, move them out to the site, and then manage the hives out there. So it's going to be like 25K in capital outlay, and then it's going to be a big responsibility to maintain those hives. It's what beekeepers do all the time, and commercial beekeepers in the audience will be like, 125 hives, that's cute. It's like most commercial beekeepers are working at least 1,000 hives, if not like 2,000 to 3,000.
Oh, geez.
Yeah. But they're doing pollination service to make the majority of their money. And honey is kind of a secondary product. Whereas we're hoping that the honey that we produce is our primary product. We pay the beekeeping operation from the mead operation a high price, like around $4 to $5 a pound bulk, which is kind of unheard of. But that then goes into the mead. And the price point of the mead can support the whole vertically integrated operation.
Got it. How are you using the regenerative apiculture group to help set standards for the project of the apiary? And if so, like, what standards are you, like, because you talked about, like, consistency of, like, flavor with the mead and the honey. That's really hard to come by in local honey. So, like, how are you trying to tackle that with what you're doing with the project that we're starting with Golden Coast?
That's an awesome question. And, I mean, one little disclaimer, like, hopefully this isn't self-dealing, you know, like, we saw a problem that needed to be solved. We've seen other industry players like Patagonia establish organic cotton, establish working groups within the garment industry to overcome problems associated with dyes and with manufacturing practices and all these things. And, like, you know, from a regulatory compliance perspective, like, hopefully we're setting ourselves a standard and then enabling ourselves to meet our mission as a benefit corporation to regenerate beekeeping in North America, which is, like, our enshrined mission in our corporate documents, right? So that being said, we are kind of leaving the quality and flavor and consistency piece for, like, different brands.
Okay.
Like, this brand is going to be kind of an estate brand.
Okay.
We're going to embrace that the honey is going to change over time. We're going to embrace that maybe different styles of meat are better suited for this honey than our core styles. Or maybe, you know, it's going to probably will go towards the, like, dry sour direction, but we're going to be like winemakers and that we're going to look at what the season's crop is giving us. And we're going to make our fermentation decisions to optimize the mead that comes out of that crop rather than having an end state in mind, finding a honey and a yeast that'll help us achieve that, and then going from there.
Got it.
We're going to start with the crop, and then we're going to say, what does this want to become? And then we're going to try and optimize our production decisions to get it to its best end state.
That's fair. That reminds me of, like, high-end specialty coffee a little bit, where you kind of follow what the green is offering rather than
what you need it to be. Or...
Yeah. That makes sense. Okay. And then when it comes to, like, measuring standards for being a regenerative land and how you're impacting bees in North America, do you have standards that, like, we're going to be transparent with, and there will be a website for it, or how is that going to all work within the apiary?
Cool. So the Regenerative Apiculture Working Group is the body that's developing those standards. We've got the draft standards. We're working on an MOU with two partner farms to roll them out, not including ours. There is a chance that ours is a partner farm, but I kind of wanted to keep them separate at this point. Because we've got so many moving parts within our operation that to make the working group dependent on our operation didn't feel good. So we've got two big farms. One of them's Rodale. One of them's Hokupoko Ranch in Molokai, Hawaii. And
are both in Hawaii?
No, Rodale is a huge organic research farm in Pennsylvania.
Oh, Pennsylvania.
Okay. Yeah. So we're at the stage of discussion where the COO has asked for revisions to the MOU to include a specific statement of work, and that's drafted. The team at Regenerative Apiculture Working Group is reviewing it, and hopefully we'll send it over. But this pollination ecologist piece is maybe a part of it. And then we've got this rangeland regeneration piece that is a part of it. Like, Rodeo wants to know what they need to measure and what they're responsible for collecting in terms of data.
Then
corollary to that is, who's going to collect the other data, and how much is it going to cost, and what's it going to be exactly? And we're working with the pollination ecologist on one of those questions. And then we've got another group, which is really cool. It's called Open Range Consulting, and they use GIS to measure change over giant rangeland to see if regenerative practices are yielding regenerative outcomes, as an increased biodiversity, increase vegetation, and potentially increase carbon sequestration. So with our land in San Diego, we want to use the standards. We have access to standards because we're helping writing them. But after year one, once we collect the preliminary data at these two partner sites, potentially three, we'll then roll that all up, refine the standards, and then publish kind of a beta test, like a public beta test, which we've got some groups, one in Austin, Texas, that's interested, one in Georgia that's interested, and people are, you know, hoping to help us get it to the next level. But we kind of wanted to do it within the Lifelines first, because it's dynamic enough with a limited number of parties.
Yeah.
So we wanted to kind of lock it down before we invited folks we didn't know directly into the collaboration.
Got it. Okay. So then through all of that, what do you see the biggest challenge being with the San Diego GCM property?
All right, before I get into answering that question, would you like more mead, sir?
I'd love more mead. Thank you.
Cheers. Your question about what challenges exist for our local apiary.
Yeah.
The two main ones that I see are varroa mite and rainfall/nectar production/drought.
Okay, so let's start with varroa mite. What's that?
So varroa mite is this parasitic mite that lives on bees and sucks their hemolymph, because bees don't have blood. They have this yellowy goo that is both their lymph liquid and their blood liquid in their bodies.
Okay.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
When you say it's yellowy goo, I just picture honey in the bee.
Well, like, have you ever gotten stung by it? It is. It's weird. If you've ever gotten stung by a bee, right, their stinger comes out and then their guts kind of pull out and then this like yellow goo kind of drips out of them out of the back.
I don't know if I've ever been like cognizant enough after I got stung by a bee to look for that, but I'll look for it next time.
Yeah, I got stung two Fridays ago on the wrist and it's all better now. But this is the first time in a while and like it's always kind of cool. You see the venom sac on the back of the stinger, like you see the muscle pulsating. Shooting the venom into you.
Okay.
And if you can like keep your wits about you while this is happening, you see the bee like crawling away, stumbling over you, and its guts like coming out of the back of it, which is sad. I got stung because I was trying to do two things at once while I was working the bees, and it's like whenever I do that, that's when I get stung. Instead of just doing one thing at a time, very zen. It's like gotta bam,
focus.
Yeah. Okay. So. Varroa mite is this parasitic mite that sucks the bee's hemolymph, and it lives right on the bee's thorax, right between its head and its abdomen. And if we had a parasite of the same relative size, it would be like we had a rabbit between our shoulder blades sucking our blood.
Really?
Yeah. That we couldn't reach.
So, so is this like a thing most bees deal with?
So it evolved, the varroa mite evolved in Asia, where Apis serrani is like this bee like this big, right? It's like as big as your thumb.
Okay.
And so this little parasite is not that big of a deal to them. They know how to remove it. They know how to live with it. It's fine.
Got it. Okay.
But when, you know, the global bee trade happened, Apis mellifera, the European honeybee, got the varroa mite. Bees with the mites got shipped around the world. And then the mite spread all around the world.
Got it. Okay. So it was a globalization problem.
Totally. Okay. Yeah. It only started happening in like the 80s and 90s. And in San Diego, before varroa mite was here, beekeepers used to make, according to my friend Alan Mikulich, who's been keeping bees in San Diego for over 40 years, like 50 to 60 pounds per hive per year. Jeez. Now we're at like 12 to 15, maybe 20 in a good year.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah.
They have that big of an impact on production?
Yeah, because you've got this like parasite.
I can't imagine having a rabbit on my shoulder and being productive.
Yeah. I don't know, honey. I'm kind of tired.
No thanks. I'm not for that.
Yeah, so that's a huge problem.
That's crazy.
There's like intense ways to deal with them, which are like these gnarly miticides and pesticides, which get into the honey if you're not really on top of it. And there are even some treatments that are like totally illegal that beekeepers are still using that like come over from Mexico. And people have been getting busted for smuggling them from
like
Mexico.
What?
It's called Apistan, I think. But then there's like Apigard and there's a few different mite treatments.
What's illegal about them?
One of them is illegal because it's like too caustic. It's too chemical. Oh. And if it gets into the honey, it can affect people that eat the honey.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. And beekeepers are supposed to mitigate that by not treating for mites before collecting honey. But it's really hard to verify that.
Got it.
Practice. So the organic practice is to use oxalic acid. Okay. And there's a couple other integrated pest management approaches, which gets pretty nerdy. But there's this cool thing called mite shaking, where you collect a jar of 100 bees.
Okay.
And then you put like 151 or, you know, grain alcohol into the jar. And then you shake it and it kills the bees. But it also knocks the mites off. And so you collect, you count the number of mites that are present on 100 bees.
Okay.
And you track that. And when it gets to a certain threshold, you treat with oxalic acid, which means that you can't put honey supers on your hive, and you can't collect honey from your hive within, I think, 2 weeks of the oxalic acid treatment. But then it knocks the mite population way down. And if you do it at the right time, that interrupts the mite's reproduction cycle.
Oh, interesting. So what does the treatment look like? What are you doing?
Yeah, I've never actually done it, but my understanding is it's a crystal.
Okay.
That volatilizes when exposed to ambient light and heat.
Okay.
So
when you say it explodes?
Yeah.
Okay. Just making
no,
sure.
It sublimates. It turns from a solid into a gas.
Okay.
Yeah. Oxalic acid is derived from like lemongrass, like sourgrass.
Okay.
It's in plants. It's a natural kind of pesticide that plants produce. And in high concentrations, you like sprinkle it on your bees in your hive. And the warmth of the hive turns it into a gas, and then that gas makes the mites fall off the bees.
Got it. And so what happens
without really hurting the bees?
I was gonna say, like, dude, I guess what's the 2 week thing for?
The 2 week thing is just, I guess the USDA said, hey, this stuff could make people sick and be bad if it was in the honey. And
got it.
Honey is it loves water. What's that called? Hydrophilic.
Okay.
And so
I love water. Does that make me hydrophilic?
Yes.
Okay.
All humans should be hydrophilic. So that hydrophilia, I guess, results like if there's ambient moisture in the air and the honey is open and there's oxalic acid dissolved in that ambient moisture, there's the chance that the honey absorbs the oxalic acid. And then when the beekeeper goes and collects that honey, there's a chance that there's the oxalic acid in the honey. And that's maybe probably not good for our humans.
Got so, it. So it's good with bees, not good for humans.
As far as, yes.
Okay. I'll take it.
Okay. Yeah. Do your research, people. If you oxalic acid, there's a lot of people who know more than I do about how to use it, but we will be learning as we do our rollout of our apiary.
No, that's fair. So essentially that's the most organic way to go about getting rid of the mites.
Yes. Fulvic acid, I think, is also an option. I know way less about it, and I'm not even sure that it's OMRI certified, but I'm pretty sure that it's OMRI certified. OMRI is the organic management something index or resources index. It's like the approved treatments that the organic program allows. So I know oxalic acid is on there, and I'm pretty sure fulvic acid is, but I'm not even sure how fulvic acid works or what the limitations on it are.
That's fair. But those would probably be the two approaches you try
to manage mites. There's also
ST, essentially.
There's also like powdered sugar. Apparently dusting your bees with powdered sugar makes them clean themselves, and then they clean each other. There's mite resistant genetics. So it's pretty cool if you think about the world, right?
Yeah.
Over here is the Western Hemisphere, and over here is the Eastern Hemisphere. Apis serrani, the Asian honeybee, evolved with varroa mite and knew how to deal with it. And, you know, bees don't just stay in one place. They move around, right? So Apis serrani was probably exposing bees in Central Asia and Central Europe to the varroa mite, right? And once you get to like the really high mountain regions, there's kind of a big separation between Asia and Europe,
right?
But in Eastern Europe, there are European honeybees that have this mite resistant behavior. When they see a larva that has a mite growing on it, they'll pull the larva out of the hive and they'll interrupt the mite's reproduction cycle.
Oh, wow. We need more of those here.
Well, so those are like your Carolinians and your like Russian European honeybees in Central Asia and Eastern Europe.
Okay.
And then over here in Western Europe, the Italian honeybees and like the, they have no idea how to deal with Apis mellifera.
They're a little bit more spoiled.
Well, they've just like evolved in a reality where they didn't have to deal with that. So they produced a ton of honey. They were super docile. Like there's trade-offs. And like the African honeybee, we're not sure what its mite resistance strategies are, but apparently it's better than the European honeybee. Okay. So there's some way to like breed a localized strain of bee that can deal with the environmental constraints, but every situation is kind of different. Like drought is an environmental constraint. How defensive you need to be is an environmental constraint. What plants you're able to pollinate and gather nectar from is an environmental constraint. And like, these are all genetic and learned behaviors. And some people say that like a queen, when she breeds with like 9 to 19 drones during her nuptial flight after leaving the hive, her maiden flight, whatever you want to call it, she'll have this like resource bank of all these different genetic stocks that she can have babies from when she needs to deal with certain environmental stressors. So like different generations of bees are more or less able to deal with different stresses.
Got it.
So that's like,
how often does that cycle occur?
Just once in the bee's life, in the queen's life.
But like human time.
So every three, well, it depends on how strong the hive is. Like it used to be when I would read about beekeeping that the beekeepers would say your queen should live for 3 to 7 years.
Oh, okay.
And like now guys are replacing their queens like every year.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And they're using artificially inseminated bees.
Oh.
So like that's a whole nother podcast.
Okay. But essentially one of the ways to tackle that problem, and even the second big problem that you mentioned, drought and all that, is to get the right bees, and hopefully over time they can evolve and be better with the environment in San Diego than the first set that you brought here.
So Mike Schmeling, who's the beekeeper at Rodale, and his mentor Kirk Webster, who was like the beginner of natural beekeeper, he started the natural beekeeping movement and lectured at Appamondia, which is like the big global conference on bees, about natural beekeeping and how his practices over 50 plus years have allowed him to create a beautiful livelihood and beautiful honey and like navigate all of these complexities. They say that a natural beekeeper needs to be raising their own queens and producing their own stock, because that's going to, you know, like any kind of livestock, it's going to allow the farmer, the rancher, the animal husbandry is going to result in the breed of animal that is best suited for that context.
Yeah. In that environment, essentially.
And like, we've lost that. Like, there is very little natural bee breeding going on. There's a guy in San Diego, Murray Mosco, at Wildflower Meadows, who was doing it for a while, and I lost track of him. I'm not sure what's going on. I should reach out to him because maybe he's the solution. Because one of the regenerative beekeeping practices is either raising your own queens and your own stock of bees, or sourcing from a local breeder who does wild breeding, which means that your queens are in a netted yard with other hives that are producing drones. And so they're breeding with your other queens, and you're creating a more concentrated genetic stock.
Got it. Okay. So that covers the rabbits on your shoulder.
Bromites. Yeah.
The other is drought.
Yeah.
And just, you know, the wonderful San Diego environment that we live in.
Oh, dear. Yeah. Yeah.
And I guess just expand on that. Like, what are the challenges there? And I think to tie it in with the mites, it's kind of like, where do you see GCM starting? Are we going to import Asian bees, Russian bees, all the bees?
Yeah,
what's your plan of attack going forward, considering all those variables?
We're using Italian bees to start, which has its trade-offs. And hopefully over time, we're going to incorporate feral bees into our stock, and we're going to breed a hybrid of Italian and feral bees that are going to be good honey producers, but resilient, more resilient than the Italians.
Got it. What are feral bees?
Feral bees are your wild hives that live in people's eaves and in their water boxes. And
just local bees of San Diego that just exist already.
Yeah. And that call, you know, Gary, our farmer's market manager, will be our lead beekeeper because he's doing beekeeping every week professionally, getting paid. And one of his main jobs is extractions, like removing bees from whomever doesn't want them in their homes or yards or whatever. And so taking those hives, putting them into a box like Texas Bee Lady does, you know.
Yeah.
The internet sensation. Dude, she's so good. Like, I watch her and I'm like, oh, that's how you don't get stung without wearing gloves and a suit. Just be chill.
Just be chill. Just meditate before you go out there.
It's true, though. They can see our energy field, I swear. They can see two more spectrums of light. They have, like, two more cones than we do. So they can see ultraviolet and infrared. And they have, like, 1,000 lenses on each compound eye. So it's a cool psychedelic reality that bees live in.
They're an ultimate vibe check.
They are. Yes. If you're stressed out and thinking about more than one thing at a time, they will bring you to the present moment. So drought is like a major problem, and we're going to try and breed a bee that can deal with it and still produce honey. But, you know, as my friend Benjamin Pixie says, like, nectar is this incredible miracle. Like, the plants do it under the perfect circumstances of moisture and heat. And if they don't get that combination of variables, they don't produce nectar. And then there's not food for the bees. And there's not enough honey for us to make mead. So, like, mead is this really precious, beautiful thing, and we've taken it for granted because we've commoditized honey. But in the wild, having enough moisture and the right temperature for the plants to produce nectar is not something you can control. So when it happens, it's like, this is awesome.
So that brings me, I don't mean to go into wine, but that's the only thing I have to bank this information on. And my understanding of wine is there's different types of wine grow best in different environments.
Totally.
And some environments are more akin to like a dessert wine, while other environmental factors, you're more prone to like a Pinot or whatever it is.
Yeah.
So depending on where you live or where your farm is, you can calibrate whatever grapes you want for your optimal wine output if you want to. So I guess my question when it comes back to mead is, there's not a, like for Southern California, even though we're drought oriented, there's not like specific plants that produce nectar well in this environment. I don't know if that makes sense or not.
What are the strategies to cope with the low moisture environment?
Yeah, like what's the environmental strategy to help the bees with
the nectar production question?
Yeah,
that's awesome. In permaculture, there's this maxim, which is plant your rain.
Okay.
And it's because healthy soil and abundant vegetation creates a water cycle.
Yeah.
Right. When there's enough soil, and this is like something that I want my neighbor to understand, because one of my neighbors is very anti things on the ground that don't, how do I put this? He does not like having leaf litter and things that will eventually decompose and become soil on the ground.
Okay.
So like, he just wants to remove everything from his property that is not like the minerals that make up the dirt.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there's no soil there. And like soil, organic matter is like a sponge, right? Yeah. When it gets wet, it stays damp for a long time. And that moisture goes into the root layer, and the trees take that up, and the trees, through hydraulic action, right? The leaves are getting hot and the roots are wet and cool. So the trees get hot, they put off moisture to cool themselves down, and the moisture in the leaves evaporates. Mm-hmm. So then it creates this hydraulic draw, because it's the whole system of the tree is trying to stay in equilibrium. And osmosis then, right, there's less moisture here and there's more moisture here. So it creates this pneumatic pressure. The tree is not pushing itself up.
Yeah.
It's the water being pulled from the roots through the trunk to the canopy that creates the force that allows the tree to grow.
Yeah.
So if there's no moisture and soil that's wet to allow, to hold that water and allow that tree to draw it up and push and grow, then there's no growth for the trees.
Yeah.
The trade-off also, or the additional benefit, is that that moisture then goes out of the trees and into the atmosphere and becomes humidity.
Yeah.
And humidity, when it gets to 100%, becomes rain. And the minerals and organic matter and microbes that are in the soil get kicked up through wind and through people and animals moving around, and they become little molecules and particles that float in the air, and they become nucleation points for that water to become clouds, and for those clouds then to become rain.
Yeah.
So a healthy system that has healthy soil and is wet creates more rain to sustain healthy soil and wetness.
Yeah.
And so that's like the stories of Easter Island, where they cut down all the trees. It became a droughted, like a totally desert island.
Yeah.
And same in, you know, Carthage and Saharan Africa. Like the Sahara didn't used to exist. It used to be a forest, but they cut it down to support this empire. And as a result, it turned into a desert with no trees.
Yeah. Brazil's future.
Well, hopefully not.
I know.
Hopefully we all like hit the pause button and go, hey, Brazil, can we pay you more for your honey than for your lumber?
Yeah.
So that the trees stay.
Bad joke.
But your acai. Like, let's also pay you for your acai fruit and other awesome products that can come from your functional rainforest.
Yeah, but I think ultimately, so one of the goals we would have with the San Diego property is to create a system like that, so drought isn't a problem.
Yeah, I would assume it's this little rain, like, well, Oak Savanna ecosystem is the climax community. And so there's a bunch of oaks, there's a bunch of grasslands, and there are ruminants, right? Big cows and other animals that eat the grass, poop. The poop then gets spread out. Well, maggots and other worms and insects grow in the poop. Birds come, they scrape the poop apart, and they spread all that nitrogen and their little packets of nitrogen. And birds digest by grinding stones in their gizzard, right?
Yeah.
So like, it's not just nitrogen that's being cycled. It's also all these minerals from the stones that are being broken down in their gizzard. So like silica and other critical components to a healthy soil. So the birds come, scrape through the poop, eat the protein in the poop that is the bugs. They then poop, and now you've got like this compost factory, natural compost factory, that's cycling carbon and nitrogen and these minerals,
and allowing the grass to grow, allowing the soil to grow, and allowing that sponge that holds the water to exist. So you're regenerating the whole system.
Yeah.
And on this land that we're working on, there is a very passionate regenerative beef grower.
Oh, cool.
So we're working to coordinate their activities and our activities so that the whole system is more capable of supporting life.
When you say beef grower, I imagine like
cattle, right?
Like beef on a plant. Like, that's interesting.
Sorry, cattle rancher, regenerative cattle rancher.
Then I just have to correct myself and be like, no, he means he's raising cows.
Yeah.
All right. So just making the land more regenerative to fight drought.
Yeah.
And combining Italian bees with local bees. So,
and ideally, like selecting breeding stock from our most productive, most honey productive, and most resilient hives.
Got it. Okay. And so, next steps of the project. Currently, we are working on getting the paperwork figured out.
Financing. Yep.
That's where we're at.
Yep.
Where do we hope to be, say, end of year?
So we have bought the initial boxes of bees. Okay. Like we have 125 one hive body hives. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Now we need to get the honey supers and move them out to the site, which means we need to get the lease dialed in. So a couple moving parts there. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, so we've bought the hives.
Yeah, we bought the first stage of the hives because we like structured the deal. The bees and the first box was one step that's paid for. Now the bees and, or now the hives and the honey supers and moving them is the next step.
Got it. And figuring out the lease
is critical to making that step happen.
Got it. And so in 6 months, where do you hope the project is at?
6 months. That would put us in November. So hopefully we've gotten the lease. We've gotten the financing. We've moved the hives out there. We've collected potentially our first crop of honey.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Okay. And so then that would mean in my head, the first batch of mead to go out with the honey is beginning of next year from this land?
Potentially. Maybe, yeah.
Potentially?
Yeah.
Okay.
That'd be cool.
It's exciting.
That would be amazing.
And we need to taste the honey before we can make any call on what kind of mead it's going to be, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's exciting. Okay. Yeah. Cool.
Thanks, man.
All right. Well, I think that covers it. You got any questions for me?
Dude, so grateful that you make this happen. And what's our next podcast about?
Our next podcast is going to be about the mead competition, I believe.
Oh, good. The U.S. Mead Open.
Yeah.
That's happening next week.
That's happening next week. So we might be a little late on that.
Well, we can talk about what happened.
Oh, yeah. Recap it.
Yeah.
And how it went.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I'm for it.
Cheers, bro.
Cheers.
Thanks.
All right, that's a wrap on our new apiary project. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us. We appreciate all the support we can get. If there's anything you'd like to know more about, feel free to email us at podcast@goldencoastmead.com with your questions, and we'll do our best to answer them for you. Now, here's your weekly bee joke. What do you get if you cross a bee and a sheep? A bah humbug. Mead out.